It's Saturday, February 7th, 2015. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. And it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed in Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me is Ben Jaffe. He's a teacher, traveler, and music geek. Hey, Ben.
Hey.
You know, Ben, I want to share one thing, a reason I love you so much. Only the one of many reasons.
The only reason.
So before the show, we are throwing tabs of browsers around. That's what we do, right? We organize our show flow. We have all the stories. We kind of throw them into one document,
a Google Doc.
And in doing that, of course, there's a lot of pasting of URLs and code and changes and things of that nature.
How do I link this text? How do I unlink this text?
And I asked quickly, how do you unlink text? Because I couldn't do it in Google Doc. And you said, Command K.
Command K.
I was like, what? Command K? And so I select the text. Command K brought up the link dialog to be able to paste in a link, which just saved me seconds of time this morning after I learned that. The funny thing is I might have learned that at one point, but you always know these shortcuts. And I just love that about you.
They stick.
They stick. Why?
Other things don't stick.
Okay.
Like taking out the garbage or, you know, mundane tasks. But keyboard shortcuts, they always stick. I don't understand why.
So Command K, it's part of your like fundamental part of who you are, I guess. You learned computers the same time as Command. And so you felt good about yourself because you learned the key commands?
Here's the thing. I hate using the mouse or the trackpad. It just seems fundamentally inefficient.
Yeah.
If I can hit two keys on a keyboard to accomplish a task rather than moving this thing to move a cursor on the screen to some coordinates and then clicking, I can save probably between half a second and 2 seconds constantly throughout the day.
You know that the time we're spending about this right now is wasting more time than all of our shortcuts all week long.
Maybe all of yours, but not
Maybe
mine.
Not for you. You use a lot.
I use a lot.
Command K works in Google Docs, but also in lots of applications to bring up. You highlight text, do the Command key, and it'll bring up the link dialog.
It's probably Control K on Windows.
Right, of course.
Other really useful ones, particularly for web developers, we are both.
I know Command C and Command V.
Command C and Command V. If you put Command or Control L before that, it'll highlight the location bar in your web browser. So if you are on some website and you're like, oh, I just got to send that to someone, you press Command L, which selects your location bar, Command C, Command Tab to your mail program, Command N, new window, type in the email address, Tab, Command V, Tab, Enter.
You just sent me a link.
I just sent you a link.
That's impressive. Anyway, so this and thousands of more hours of this kind of content.
This is horrible radio content.
I know, I love it.
But I will say that if you memorize two or three of the most common keyboard shortcuts, you will save yourself minutes a day, hours a month.
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right.
And people look at you like you're some kind of crazy wizard.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, this is sorcery.
So I help on Steve Wozniak's website. And so I kind of follow any Steve Wozniak news. And this week,
who's Steve Wozniak?
Steve Wozniak is the founder, one of the founders of Apple Computer. He was the one that built the first Apple computers. And
the reason these computers are in front of us.
These computers are in front of us. In fact, one of the patents he did was to be able to create a color display, from a computer onto a TV screen. And he has a patent on that. And he figured it out. Anyways, Woz is great. We had a show with Woz. It's up on our archive somewhere.
A really cool guy.
You know what? We'll link Steve Wozniak's episode of Geek Speak on our webpage for today. Got that, Chandler?
Cool.
All right, cool. And so anyways, so Woz in this week was talking about how important Radio Shack was to the development in Silicon Valley. And I won't get into the details of that, but that leads great into your story about why is Radio Shack?
Just a couple days ago,
I declare bankruptcy.
That's Michael Scott of Radio Shack. No, I'm kidding.
No,
that's
not
from
really.
The Office. But that is what Radio Shack very recently did. They declared bankruptcy. Actually, just 2 days ago. That was on Thursday.
Kind of sad.
And they set up a deal to sell 2,400 of their roughly 4,000 stores to Sprint. Ah. So Sprint is the company that's getting all of the Radio Shack stores.
And that makes sense. Sprint's of course a phone company. They've been selling Sprint phones in Radio Shacks for quite a few years now.
I miss those stores when they used to sell radio components.
Would those stores just be Sprint stores, or would those stores be kind of Radio Shack-y Sprint stores? Do we not know?
I actually don't know. Okay. I mean, maybe some article has elaborated but
that's not all the stores.
Yeah, so the remaining, what would that be, 4,000 minus 2,400 is 1,600. The remaining stores are expected to close, aside from the franchise locations and stores in Mexico and Asia. Those are not included in this deal. What's going to happen with them, we're not sure. And it's also not a surprise that Radio Shack announced bankruptcy. This has kind of been coming for a while. And, They've also already converted some of their locations to clearance stores, so they've been on this path for a while. But for those of us who weren't in the know, like I hadn't been following the story, I saw that and I'm like, oh my God, Radio Shack. Oh,
I know,
no.
It's kind of sad, right?
Well, I used to really like Radio Shack. These days, not so much. They sell phones and RC cars.
Yeah.
And
I'm always a little disappointed going to a Radio Shack. I mean, the truth is, I love that they're there because, I mean, as Waz, says, it's one of the reasons why he was able to be successful in electronics. But the truth is now, I don't actually buy a lot of stuff at Radio Shack. I mean, I have gone and gotten connectors and stuff. Things are almost always overpriced and difficult. And, of course, I'm comparing that to online stores, right? I mean, of course, you can buy pretty much anything you buy at Amazon. At Radio Shack, you could buy at Amazon anyway. So, of course, that's going to affect them. But there's also these really great companies about doing, like, homegrown electronics. Like, if you're interested in building hardware, the resources that are available at, like, SparkFun and Adafruit are these fantastic resources. They post a new product that they're covering, and then how-tos on using it. Here's a green laser. This is how you power it. This is how you set it up. You want to set it up to an Arduino and control it and freak out your cat robotically. All that instructions is just all there, right?
Freak out your cat.
And so with Make Magazine, of course, is another resource for this kind of stuff. So when you want to do that kind of playing around with hardware, there's so many resources out there. Speaking of one of those, this week Raspberry Pi 2 came out, and Raspberry Pi, of course, is a microcomputer, like a $35 computer, and it can kind of do what normal computer can do, but not as strong. But it's like $35, right?
It's like a teeny computer. It's kind of amazing.
And the power supply for it, you just plug it into a wall wart, which is like a little tiny power supply, or you run it by batteries.
Wall warts are those really ugly things that always take up way more ports than they should.
It's a transformer, basically.
Yeah, you get a power strip, you can get like maybe three wall warts in there, maybe. Max.
And I call them wall warts because when they're on the wall, they look like a big wart. Anyway, those power supplies are pretty inexpensive. And the Raspberry Pi, just to let you know what it does, it has double the RAM now. It's got a gigabyte of RAM, which is...
gigabyte of RAM for $35? Is that what you said?
You can't. I know.
What?
It's so frustrating because like if you try to buy RAM updates for phones and stuff, it costs more than that, right? But anyway.
You just blew my mind. I didn't realize it had that much onboard memory.
No, this thing is... It's a 900 megahertz ARM7.
Uh-huh.
And... It also has more features expanded to the pins. One of the things about the reason why this little computer, the Raspberry Pi 2, exists is for running projects, right? Like you want to do something fun, you want a little computer, but you don't want to like take a Mac Mini and stick it in the corner because that's kind of overkill.
I have done that.
Yeah, I have too. So these devices, it's got USB, it's got HDMI out, it's got all the features set that you might want to do for like a home media system. You're going to have to find a hard drive, of course. It's got flash RAM, but you can, of course, put a whole operating system on a USB stick and plug it in and boot the whole thing. So we're talking about a small computer for $35, and now it's got a gig of RAM. You can run Windows 10 on it. I mean, it's... I don't know if you'd want to, but you could. And, of course, most people that run these run on Unix flavors. Linux.
Linux, Unix.
Yeah.
That is really cool.
That's cool.
So that's actually something I've been wanting to get into.
Hardware.
Maybe the new year will bring this.
It's already February, Ben.
Oh, yeah. I guess it's time. It's almost time for April Fool's. So I should start thinking about that and
we'll
stop thinking about New Year's resolutions.
Absolutely.
Actually, don't people stop doing New Year's resolutions by like mid-February?
Yeah, they're done now.
So
gotta wait next year.
God, 10 months before I can get into hardware.
That's true.
Bummer.
All right, Ben. Let's talk a little bit about machine learning, shall we?
I love machine learning. Actually, my newly found love for machine learning came when I started doing a podcast with a friend of mine at the company I work for, Udacity. And
what's the podcast called?
Linear Digressions, lineardigressions.com. And And we talk about machine learning. We talk about statistics. We talk about all kinds of stuff.
So, yeah, it's been very edifying. I enjoy you being on a different flavor of show.
Have you been listening?
Yep. Yeah. The episodes, well, I heard your machine learning one.
Yeah.
The first one. Well, first two of them, I think I've heard.
Yeah.
What was I going to say about that? Oh, the format of them being shorter is quite nice. When I make a commitment to listen to Geek Speak, I'm talking about an hour, right?
Yeah.
But commitment to your show, it's normally about 10 minutes. So
yeah, roughly 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
8 to 12 or
anyway,
something.
It's LinearDigressions.org.
.com.
Oh, I see how it is.
So, I see how it is. Yeah, we're a company.
We're GeekSpeak.org, by the way.
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I should have gotten org, too.
Whatever.
Maybe I did. But anyway, so this story is about machine learning. So before I talk about this particular story... I'll talk about machine learning in this particular story. So machine learning is this topic that feels really daunting and scary and confusing and complicated, but fundamentally the concept is very simple. So here's the idea. The story here is that some researchers have used people at Yahoo Labs specifically have created a machine learning algorithm that tries to figure out if photographs are beautiful or not, which, you know, as a headline is like, oh my God, the robot overlords, right? But this is just a machine learning algorithm that you feed it a photograph and it comes out with basically a guess. I think, or the learning algorithm has determined that this is 80% on the beauty scale or something. So what it's looking at is it's looking at particular things like, say, if we're just talking about portraits, by the way, it'll find the left eye and the right eye and the nose and the mouth and the background, and it'll look at things like how sharp are the eyes and mm-hmm. how fuzzy is the background, what's the color saturation on the different things, right? Now, you can't just feed photographs into a machine learning algorithm tabula rasa and expect it to understand what human beauty is. So here's actually where the machine learning comes in. What you do is you give the machine learning algorithm, say, in this case, 1,000 photos, or maybe it was 10,000.
And the knowledge or ability to isolate eyes and isolate face and background? Like, is that part of what you built into it?
Yeah, so there are algorithms that are optimized for that, right?
Okay, so now it has your large data set of photos, and it has these algorithms that can process on them to get knowledge like this is the eye region, and this is
how fuzzy it is.
These are different data sets, basically. Okay.
Different data points.
Okay, I'm kind of getting that.
Okay,
all right, so that's not the learning part, though, right? That was all manually programmed.
So you take those 1,000 or 10,000 individual pictures. You run them through the learning algorithm and you tell the learning algorithm, I want you to optimize for these particular outcomes. So these images don't come alone. These images come with what we call metadata, data about the photographs.
Mm-hmm.
You have a bunch of humans go through and say, this is a really beautiful photo. This is not a beautiful photo. This is a really, really beautiful photo, right? And then you take that data of what's beautiful and what's not, and you tell the machine learning algorithm, go ahead and tweak yourself and twist yourself and change yourself to optimize for taking this input and getting this output.
Okay, wait, let's go through this again. So the software has a collection of photographs, mm-hmm. and it also has the ability to inspect the photographs in different ways. Like it has an algorithm that automatically isolates eyes and has values about that, like whether both eyes are in the picture, whether they're blurry. It also has an idea of saying, well, this is an area that's specified by the human versus the background, and the ratio of that it knows. So it has a whole bunch of like things it can calculate off of any image it wants, any time it wants,
yeah.
that gives you some values.
So those are the inputs.
So those are the inputs it has.
The outputs.
Then it also has, a whole bunch of information on what people think about the photo. This is awesome. This is not awesome. And those, so then it's told, we want you to rank, change all those number parameters, look at values that correlate to what people say the photo is good. So a simple example of this would be, humans might like pictures that are that have more eyes that are more in focused.
Yeah.
The computer doesn't know that humans like that, but the computer knows all the images that the humans like. And if there's a correlation of the eye area being focused in that data set, and mm-hmm. that's a high correlation to what people liked, then the data set gets pushed such that the output is what people like.
Now,
that's complicated. It's two different data sets kind of working together.
Yes, but I want to just take one more minute and step back a little bit further and talk about this more conceptually.
Okay.
Right? So imagine that now we're not looking at photographs. We're just trying to tell a computer, hey, go ahead and shoot a ball at this target and try and hit the target. Okay.
Okay.
So
it's kind of like a robotic launcher.
Yeah. So you know your input. You know, let's say the speed of the thing that throws the ball and that kind of stuff, and your release point and all that. You also know your target, right? And
right.
I think the target is the bullseye. So if the machine learning algorithm tries to hit the target and it goes a little too far to the left,
it changes some of its numbers.
Now, it doesn't know that it needs to turn right in order to fix this problem, but it can experiment and see what kinds of changes better optimize hitting this target and that target and that target.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, after all this optimization and tweaking and everything like that, now you have a machine learning algorithm that's perfect at hitting these three bullseyes, or that's perfect at determining the beauty of these 1,000 images. Then if you give it another bullseye somewhere else, if you've done it well, then it'll be able to figure out how to hit that bullseye based on the other information from the labeled data set.
Okay. And the reason why we call it machine learning, that idea, is that it's trial and error kind of assessment.
Yeah. Now, it might we're not pulling the strings.
Right. In one situation with the targets, it was actual physical trial and error, like experiments being run.
Yeah.
In the other one, it's just data set pattern matching such that the output matches the input.
Exactly.
Or it matches the desired input. So these are both machine learnings, and it's very much like, you know, people learn as well, right?
Exactly.
We try to stand up. We keep falling over until successfully stand up. We've learned how to stand up, right?
Yeah. That
takes trial and error.
This is for another – actually, there is an episode on linear regressions about this, but we have taken a lot of lessons that we've learned about the human brain and applied those to machine learning algorithms and come up with some really, really good algorithms from that. For example, facial recognition using neural nets. Very similar to the way – very simplified way that the brain works. So,
awesome.
Really cool stuff. They've come up – ultimately, the story is – this particular story is they've come up with an algorithm that can generally figure out whether portraits are beautiful or less beautiful, and then they can do things based on that, like say, you want this photo, you don't want that one, throw that one out.
You are listening to KOSP. This is Geek Speak. In the air with me is Ben and Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. Hey, coming up on the next 7th Avenue Project, we throw a birthday party for Einstein's greatest idea. The theory of general relativity turns 100 this year. It completely overturned our view on the universe, and a century after its discovery, people are still struggling with its implications. On this edition of the 7th Avenue Project, getting to know and love Einstein's theory of general relativity, hosted by KOSP's Robert Pauly, and that, of course, is tomorrow here on KOSP, and also is available at the 7thAvenueProject.com. Ben, last week, unfortunately, I neglected to let you get to a story about YouTube, and I love the YouTubes.
We run out of time. Not your fault. I don't blame you much.
But publicly.
So YouTube, as we know, is the popular video playing and sharing site. And the technology that they use to get the video from their servers to your computer, the way that it's being displayed by default was with, I almost said Macromedia Flash. That's the company
awesome.
That owned Flash before Adobe
created
bought them.
It,
so
yeah.
Adobe Flash. So they were using this, basically this plugin to the browser, Adobe Flash, to deliver this video content. And there were a couple different reasons. One was that the HTML5 video tag wasn't quite ready. The specification, all that stuff.
When YouTube started, the only way you could play video on the internet was by Flash, basically.
Yeah, you couldn't say...
I think there was QuickTime Player as well, but
hey,
basically...
Hey, browser, play a video.
Right.
Nope. Don't know how to do that.
And, you know, Flash was this dominant player. Adobe had this market of being able to play video and actually interactive websites in this great way, because if you had the Flash plugin, you had this large programming tool set at your disposal in the browser.
Especially advertisements.
Yes.
Like those ads that started showing videos instead or animations. Like, whoa, eye goes over there.
And the dress, and it was kind of frustrating as a web developer. You had to learn Flash as well if you wanted to do dynamic sites. There's always this dichotomy, and you had to force users to upload. Anyway, when the iPhone came out, Apple said, nope, no Flash, which basically killed Flash. It basically made it such that if you wanted a website that would work on a growing number of devices, Now, of course, smartphones outnumber computers, and so the drop of Flash happened pretty quickly after that.
And also, Android tried to get Flash on there, but they couldn't get the performance up. So, I mean,
Flash was this amazing system. It's an amazing application tool set. But
it really is. Everyone loves to hate it, especially now.
We've covered lots of stories, unfortunately, about Flash having vulnerability issues. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the issues with our current browsers that we support, that we suggest, Chrome, even Safari, and Firefox. These are, their core features are actually open sourced. And so you can actually see the code that's running. In fact, Chrome, you can build yourself and deploy on your computer, which means that you know what's in it and you know what it's doing, or somebody does. It's auditable.
You can.
Yeah.
Now.
You can't do that with the Flash. Adobe's
is
proprietary.
It's closed.
Yeah, it's closed.
It's a black box.
Right. So you might not know a vulnerability exists until after it's been exploited. That's a problem. But also it might be doing stuff that's a little devious. So there's a concern about closed source software, and the open software movement, which we've talked to different people in open software movement on Geekspeak before. Stallman's been on the show before.
Yep.
Hopefully we'll find the link for
Richard
Stallman. That guy has an
epic beard.
You got that, Chandler? Richard Stallman show on Geekspeak. We'll see if we find him. In any case, we talk about this idea that if you're the computers, the software that's running on the computer should be modifiable, at Stallman's perspective, but also potentially knowable. And there's this concern as, and Cory Doctorow speaks a lot about this concern. I personally love Cory Doctorow. Have you ever read any of his books?
I have actually not.
Oh, I got to get some books of Cory Doctorow's. My son and I are both addicted to him. But Cory is one of the founders of Boing Boing, and he also
prolific person.
And his, current, he goes through talks and talks about his books, but also, and his books kind of cover these topics, but he also talks in general about how evil DRM is.
Mm-hmm. And he's very outspoken.
Yeah, DRM button.
So, digital rights management, the idea that you can play a video on your computer, but it's not recordable. You can't steal it, right? It's rights management on these digital assets that you're downloading.
Yeah.
DRM.
And so this sounds like a really kind of fine idea. I mean, I personally work for Netflix, and I have to kind of bring that into the story because it's associated to some degree.
Yeah.
Netflix, we encrypt all of our encrypt all of our media that we send over, and we also send over the key to unencrypt it, and the player then loads that key into its space and decrypts the video. And send it to the video card, which makes it hard for you to steal it or copy it, excuse me.
Netflix and other companies that are distributing video basically don't want you to be able to go and sit and watch The Office and take all of the video files and then redistribute them across the world to other people, right?
So this is all done with DRM. And the problem is, and this is Corey's perspective, and I highly agree with it, if you have a computer and I give you something and I say you can't copy it. First off, it's crazy because when you download a video from Netflix, when you stream a video from Netflix.
By definition, you're copying it.
You're copying it. That's what it's doing.
It's being stored somewhere on your computer so that way it can play back and you can see it.
And we can't make a computer that can do some things but not other things. Computers, as Turing has said, the Turing complete concept of a computer means any computer can do is Turing complete, it can do anything any other computer can do. That fundamental concept is actually amazing that it works at all. But basically, we don't know how to make partially functioning computers. We know how to make general purpose computers.
It's kind of an opt-out thing. You can't make an entire very open infrastructure system and then put a safe in the middle of it.
Right.
It's just really hard to do.
But unfortunately, that's what DRM requires.
Mm-hmm.
Because I need, if I'm sending you a video and I want you to not be able to redistribute or copy it in a way that other people can see it, I need to somehow make your computer do what I want, even though it's your computer.
So you're putting a safe in my house.
Yes.
But you're not giving me the key or
that's
the combo.
Right. And that's Dr.
And you have the combo. But
yes.
I don't. And it's in my house. So
it's your ownership, right? Your computer is your ownership, right?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I feel not comfortable, but I feel okay about DRM on my computer. It doesn't weird me out like when I realize, oh, that's DRM. But the idea of a safe in my house on my property that I can't open, that only someone else can open, that feels really weird to me.
And this has been Cory Doctorow's lecturing point for a while is his first law is if somebody lock something on your computer, on your space, but doesn't give you the key, that lock is not for you. Right, it's not your. It's
not for you. Like not beneficial for you.
Right, it's not for you. It's for them. So let me tie this back to the YouTube. Let me tie this back to this concept of Flash. Okay.
Oh yeah. So we had Flash.
Yeah.
Right?
So one of the concerns we had with Flash is that there's this closed source software that has control on your computer. It's running on your computer, but we don't know how it operates, and there might be vulnerabilities in it. We're not really sure.
Yeah.
Well, so it's a dangerous thing. You have to trust. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because if it's done wrong, there might be a backdoor, and Flash had a lot of problems. Okay. So now...
And there's a history of that. There's a history of Flash having security problems.
Okay.
And so...
So now let's step forward with how video is being played on your computer now. What YouTube actually did. YouTube moved from Flash to HTML5.
And they've been doing that for a while. They've been kind of slowly testing out this HTML5 player. They've been testing out DRM with it.
And Netflix is also moving to HTML5. In some browsers, when you go to Netflix.com and play a video, it won't require Silverlight anymore. Silverlight's Microsoft alternative to Flash. It will actually play the player, play directly in the player. It works, I think, in Chrome and Firefox.
Here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
HTML5 is an open spec.
Yes.
You can go...
Defined by the W3C.
Yeah, you can read every line in the specification that the browser is following. How is it that something in this open spec can be so closed?
So this is this interesting pattern that happened, and it happened a couple years ago. So a few years ago, the W3C started in this working group that talks about HTML player, started talking about this idea of supporting digital rights management in the open standard and how to do that. And Doctorow right away was very negative against that. And I took on his same ideas. In fact, when I first met somebody at Netflix and the person that later would actually hire me, I attacked him on stage and said, "Hey, what is this? Why are you forcing DRM into the open standards?"
You attacked him on stage?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about geek culture is, you know, intellectual debate about technology is totally valid.
It's generally appreciated.
Yeah. So that's why I feel comfortable talking about this whole topic, even though it's a little strange. So what happened, and Corey's actually blaming the W3C working group to actually allow this to happen. The working group did make a suggestion, and the suggestion that they came up with was a thing called EME.
EME?
Yeah, it's the actual standard. The EME is Encrypted Media Extension. The draft was made, the draft is always going and kind of working, and it's actually pretty active. In fact, it was edited on the 20th of January.
It's in current development.
Yeah, and the way these things are, it's a request, these drafts are requests for feedback, and after a while, implementers implement the technology. But basically what it is, it's part of the standard that allows you to load a small bit of running software into the browser. And that little running interface, that interface to run in the browser, is would be the encryption, the DRM piece.
Okay, so that is the black box.
Yes,
that
the black
piece.
Box is very small now, but it's still a black box. It's good analogy. You don't know what it does inside.
Okay.
So
let's
talk about how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in general, now if you're using HTML5, your browser supports this standard called EME, and it allows a video player, the video tag you talked about in HTML5.
Yes,
indeed. It used to be like an image tag. Now it's video tag. There's another one. It says, "Hey, video tag, here's my my feed. This is the plugin thing I need. Go get it." And it then an implementation of Firefox, for example, will then go to Adobe and download this little piece of code then and run in your browser that then will theoretically safely handle the decryption of the video stream. And done correctly, it's very hard to bypass the system. The code is just the codec piece, and the real details about it, I'm a little fuzzy on, and I want to get more clarity on how the spec actually worked. So yesterday, I'm reading up about the story and kind of thinking about it, and I saw that one of the people on the W3C EME extensions is a colleague of mine at Netflix. So this week, I'm going to investigate this and find out how
technically.
Yeah, it's fun. So, not a friend of mine, it's somebody I work with, but I'm looking forward to talking to Mark this week about where that piece of code, how it gets embedded into the browser, what could it theoretically do at the processor level? Mm-hmm. I've also chatted with a PR rep from NVIDIA to talk about, is the video card itself, is there some kind of isolated place that code can run that can't access general memory space? Because if you could do this in such a way that you downloaded it, but you ran it in a subsystem that didn't have general access, then the black box control mm-hmm. is lessened. So this is the space I'm kind of playing in right now. I thought it was kind of an interesting story to share with
you. So on a personal note, is that awkward? Because you're working at a company that's a proponent of DRM. You generally agree with someone who's anti-DRM. And you're somewhat of a public figure because you're on GeekSpeak.
So, Okay, so Doctorow's, let me clarify why Doctorow's views are so crucial. And that is that his general concept here is that general purpose computers are everywhere, right?
Yeah.
We drive in computers. Like my computer, my car has a computer in it, and it controls almost everything I do besides the steering wheel.
Yeah, you have a Leaf.
Yeah, electric vehicle.
I have a Yaris. Yeah. My Yaris is also a computer. Like it's not just the new cars.
Every car since 75 has had a computer at some level. Mm-hmm. And over time, the computer systems got more and more complicated and control more and more. I mean, your ability to brake quickly and having the auto-engaged braking system.
The anti-lock braking.
That's a computer-controlled system. And it's done that way because the computer can do it better than a human being, right?
Computers can do a lot of things.
Right, so
faster,
your anti-lock-up braking system, that's a highly useful feature. And we see cars being more and more safe because of computers' embedment. But those computers run on software, and the software can be modified. And we don't know what's running in that software. So we've talked about cars having vulnerabilities to security systems, brakes engaging accidentally because of a software bug, or vulnerability to external infiltration. So there's real concerns about that general computer's ability to be safe. And that's growing everywhere. They're everywhere, right? Our phones are computers. I mean, all of our appliances, our home, are computer controlled, except for they think the toaster is still not.
Blender?
Yeah, sure. Blender. I mean, yeah, blenders have computers.
At least
in them.
The ones that change their speed automatically.
And all of these things are general purpose computers. All of them have Turing complete instruction set. They can be told to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you make a law that says the manufacturer controls what's going on in there, and you as an owner has no idea and can't know.
That's by default. By definition, that is putting a black box.
Yes.
In what, especially in the case of browsers, is an otherwise completely open system.
That's right. And as we get more reliant on these computer systems to do what we want, and as the companies that make them have more desire to control what they do, we have this dichotomy of the stuff you own doing the stuff a corporation wants. And that's scary when it's everything in your life. Mm-hmm. And Doctorow is one of Cory Doctorow's greatest examples is hearing aids. You know, the rock and roll generation that are going deaf, mm-hmm. and they need hearing aids. Hearing aids now are not just amplified systems. They're digital processors. They're computers. And theoretically, if you put code in there, you could select what a person hears or not. This sounds far-fetched and crazy, but that's the kind of stuff we've got to deal with when we're trying to allow companies to control what's in our homes.
Yeah.
And that's why the DRM thing is so tricky, because it's an example of, yeah, we're going to run something on your computer, and you don't know what it does. And that, to me, is bad.
Yeah. And it's not just things in your homes. I mean, there's actually a story I'll put up on GeekSpeak of farmers struggling with their farming equipment because it's becoming more high tech. And so if something simple breaks, it'll just stop and say, call a technician.
Yes.
And I'll have to get a technician out there to reset the system. And it's not so much that they can't fix the machine. It's that the computer is closed.
Now, one more thing about the W3C, because I sit on another committee of the W3C, so I understand how they work. The way it works is contributors come together and experts come together, and they talk and try to figure out the best solutions.
Uh-huh.
These are people trying to solve complicated problems, and they do it openly. They share everything what they're doing. I think the solution the W3C came up with the EME extension thing, the encrypted media extensions, was a really good solution to the problem of how do we make video playable with DRM support without kind of endangering. They made a great decision there in my mind. I'm going to learn more about that. But the point is that the less closed source software we have, the better. The more open we have, the more knowledge we'll have about how systems work, the safer the systems will actually be. So I believe in open source software, and I see where that line is. And it's just a gray line. It's an interesting place to talk about.
Yeah, I fully agree.
You're listening to GeekSpeak on 88.9 KSP and KSP.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the studio with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben, we talked about natural language processing, and then we talked a bit about DRM.
Machine learning we talked about.
Oh, sorry, machine learning. We talked about DRM. Can we get back to some kind of machine learning stuff?
Yes, specifically natural language processing. Hey!
Hey!
We do organize our doc on a doc, it's clear. I just want to give a shout out to a startup, which is it's led by two MIT graduates, and it just came out. It's called Beansprock. Now,
what? That's a great name.
Actually, wait. Ask me why.
Okay, why is it called Beansprock?
All right. The name Beansprock is, this is a quote, meant to convey the idea of climbing a beanstalk like a corporate ladder, and also sprockets, but mostly the domain was only $9.99.
Love it. So, domains, of course, are domain names like yahoo.com, geekspeak.org. Those are domain names. Or beansprock.com.
So actually, this is a cool story, or it's a cool startup. What they're doing is they're using AI. They're using natural language processing and some artificial intelligence and whatnot. And I'm not sure what else it's driving it to look at your LinkedIn profile and try to match you with a job rather than have humans do it.
Good, because humans are horrible at that work.
Right. And actually, so just for the heck of it, I went through this process.
Oh, you did?
This morning.
Yeah.
I actually onboarded with them just to see what it was.
Ben's looking for a job. No, I'm just kidding.
Right.
Tried it out.
And it was an incredibly well done experience. It was a really, really well done experience. Well, I've been thinking a lot about onboarding recently.
Can you describe what natural language processing actually is?
It's basically algorithms that allow machines to pull meaning out of English, or rather natural language, right? Whether it's English or another language is irrelevant.
So like Siri and Google Now.
Google
Now, whatever the voice service is. But Siri, when you ask it a question, it has to parse your question into some kind of meaning, and sometimes it actually gets it right.
Siri, what is natural language processing?
That is what I do, Ben.
Yeah, and what was the other thing I was going to say?
So you said that Beansprock took your look at your LinkedIn account, which basically has a resume of yours.
Yeah, it just like sucked in all that
sucked
data.
Sucked all the data.
And then here's actually
talk about trust.
What? Right.
Go on.
Who knows how it works? It's a black box. I mean, that's what we do every day. Of course, is trust various black boxes. But it was really smart. It asked me not only did it ask me what I care about and what I'm looking for, but it also asked me about all of the past places I worked and what they seemed to care about and what they were kind of looking for. So like, do you care about happy hour with friends or having lunch with your coworkers or debating things and da da da? And it would ask me, what do I want? And it would also ask me about my previous jobs. So imagine if everyone in Silicon Valley or everyone in the world conceivably were to do this, then Beansprock would have a massive database of companies and roughly what it's like on the inside.
Yeah.
And then they'd be able to match those companies up with people who have particular interests.
So it's not just like the skill set list down. Oh, look, Ben can do Perl and this company needs a Perl programmer.
Exactly. That's generally the paradigm up until now.
Yeah.
What are your skills? Do you match?
Right.
Do these companies need those skills? Cool, you have a match, but maybe not. Maybe.
And of course, skills in computer area, at least, skills vary so quickly. But I've got Perl in my resume. Like, I'm a good Perl programmer. I haven't touched it for years, and I'm not going to try touching it, right? Like, but also, what Perl is now is not something I know. Like, the language has changed enough such that it's not something I rely upon.
That's like me in ActionScript, which is the language of Flash.
That's right. Are you a really good ActionScript programmer?
I used to do it.
You want a job doing it?
No, I really don't.
That's good, because no one does anymore.
I really don't. If you're looking for a job, it's an interesting startup. Now, I have no idea how successful it will be. As part of the experience, when I did this morning, they said, hey, yeah, we'll let you know on Monday if we find any matches for you. Now, I know they can look right now, and they can find within a couple seconds.
Right. Why are they telling you to wait?
Because they understand humans. Like, these MIT grads, not only are they good at design and machine learning and NLP and all that stuff, but like there's an element of humanity that you need to capture in order to make a good product. You can't just make a technically superior product and expect it's going to take off, you know?
Yeah. You know,
it reminds me of like 5 years ago, Google versus Apple. Google made extremely functional products with tons of features. Apple made functional products with not very many features, but really good design. And Apple's the one who has way more net worth than Google.
Hey, so this week, I'm going to go to the Twitter story now. Twitter CEO Dick Costolo was asked by Lindy West. Now, Lindy West is someone who uses Twitter quite a bit. and actually has harassed quite a bit on Twitter. This is a unfortunate, very common problem. And you might have heard a story on This American Life, which, by the way, is here on Geeks on KUSP on Sundays at 11 a.m. to 12 a.m. with Ira Glass, a story about Lindy West, about her experience on Twitter. Now, I haven't heard the story yet, so I don't know if it covers it well. But basically, Lindy is one of those people that gets harassed on Twitter. And so Dick Coslow said in response, "We suck at dealing with abuse and trolls on the platform, and we've sucked at it for years," which is kind of a nice, refreshing thing. So
it's a CEO basically being like,
yeah, that happens.
We fail at this. Yes. We're really, hey, let it not be unclear. We are horrible at
this. That's right. And he also says it's all my fault. Somebody's fault but mine.
You don't hear that very often from CEOs.
It was refreshing. It's why it made the coverage, I think. Mm-hmm. But what I think is really interesting about this story is that it is extremely hard problem to work, right? We have very short bites of discussion, and people sometimes are jerks, and on the internet, doubly so. And so start to filter? Twitter's perspective is you don't filter anything. It all goes out there.
Let it all go.
And unfortunately, the way Twitter works, if you know somebody else's handle and you want to talk to them, you can kind of publicly speak to them, like open letters.
@Lyle blah blah blah.
That's actually my Twitter handle. It's Lyle. KUSP Geeks is the Twitter handle for Geek Speak. If you want to cover that, @KUSP Geeks. We post whenever we do shows and some of this other stuff. But basically, anytime you want to say something to those people, to anybody on the account, you can just embed their name basically in the tweet. And therefore, it's really easy to harass people. And you can make accounts that are kind of anonymous. There's verified accounts, but most accounts are actually anonymous. I mean, theoretically, my account is me, but there's no reason to think that, really, because I don't have a verified account, right? There's no way that says this was Lyle. All that happened was I was the first one to grab that name, just like Geeks was taken, so I had to use KUSP Geeks as the name, which is valid. But the point is that the names are just grabbed up willy-nilly. Sometimes there's trademark issues, but because of that, you don't really know who you're talking to, and people can be anonymous, and they can be jerks about it.
Mm-hmm.
So what Twitter actually does from here on out to actually improve that is up in the air. I don't know, but at least they're saying, yeah, that's a serious problem. We know it's a problem, and we've got to fix it, which is really cool. Twitter also this week signed a contract with Google, and this happened before as well, where Google is actually going to start giving tweets back in the Google search results. It allows them to do a handshaking deal. That will be implemented later this year. It's kind of complicated because there's so many tweets out there. But if you think about what Google does, inherently Google is not a real-time service. It looks at pages, it indexes them, and then it shows the results. And though it has systems in place to check websites fast, like news sites and stuff, it'll check really quickly. The best real-time feed of knowledge is actually, from a computer perspective, is the tweet feed, right? It's mm-hmm. got, if a fire breaks out, the first place it's on the internet is in a tweet. It's amazing. So Google's going to be working on pulling in that data and sharing with the search results. Google actually does a really good job, of course, with spam and with harassment kind of content. And so hopefully they'll help in that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But once this goes online, finding news on Twitter, you can actually do through Google, which will actually be a lot easier for all of us because finding stuff on Twitter is actually difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. The searches, they got better at search, but it's not great. All right.
Not great.
Oh, and then one last thing is that because of an iOS 8 bug, that was the new operating system for iPhones and iPads that came out recently, because of a bug, it looks like 4 million users were lost on the Twitter network because of this bug.
What?
So the idea was
just
that,
like, they just lost them.
Yeah. Well, you know, basically when you use your iOS device with Twitter, it's actually embedded in the operating system, and so you use it quite a bit. If, on the other hand, it stops not to work anymore, it becomes really hard to use the service. And, of course, people not using a service means they stop using the service. I mean, it's really the momentum is the thing that gets you.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Anyway.
Yikes. That's why downtime for people like – or for companies like Twitter and Facebook is a really big deal.
It is. It is definitely a big deal. All right. Ben, I jumped around a little bit, so let's go ahead and go back to your
Anthem.
Yeah, please.
Oh, boy. So if you use Anthem, that's the second largest health insurer in the United States, if you use Anthem. Anthem has suffered a very large data breach. And probably if you use Anthem.
I don't know what Anthem is.
Anthem is like Anthem Blue Cross and, yeah.
Medical insurance.
Medical insurance, health insurance.
Thank you.
If you are a customer with that, you probably already know that because they've emailed all their subscribers. But what I would like to say, and this is just a quick thing, but very, very important, is if you are an Anthem customer and you get an email that looks like it's from Anthem saying like, hey, click here and just don't. Just don't. Because probably what's happening is Anthem is not going to email you and be like, here, click on here for free identity theft monitoring or something. They're not going to do that through email.
They might send an email, but they won't have a link in it.
If they're gonna distribute anything or give any information, it's going to be through their secure website. So if you're getting news from Anthem, you're probably going to be able to get it by logging into their secure website. If you get an email that says, click here and start a year of free identity theft monitoring, do not click that, right? Because what you're probably doing is you're clicking on a fake email and you're sending your security, social security number. And all right.
So if you're so what you have to do is you have to do like a Google search on Anthem and then find their website and then click there and log in, because then it's the right site.
Absolutely.
Don't trust the email going to your box because it might be the wrong site. Okay.
Yeah, it probably is the wrong site. Yeah. So they actually, Anthem has also publicly acknowledged the fact that there are plenty of scamming and phishing emails going out there. So again, don't click on things in your email and then give your date of birth and security and social security number.
Yeah.
Just don't. So that's a quick news story. I've got another quick one.
Sure.
If you're a Verizon customer, Verizon has dropped their data rates, but you may not know it. If you're a current customer of Verizon, you may be eligible to get a lower data rate, but you have to call to get it. Wah, wah. Bad news, Verizon. Bad job.
This is the master cookies, or the never-ending cookie thing that they were doing for a while, that basically allows websites potentially to track you, right?
It is?
Oh, that's the data rates. I'm sorry. Sorry.
This is how much money you pay them for data.
Oh, okay. That you can drop.
You can drop it by like $10 a month.
There's another story, and I guess I don't have a link to it, so I'll back off. That talks about opting out of the super cookie, but you don't have to call them.
We covered that a couple months ago,
yeah.
Maybe.
So you have to call them to get the data drop price. There's no other way to do it online or anything.
I don't think so.
That's so frustrating.
It's really awful. Now, this is actually a perfect opportunity to bump resellers like Ting, and there are other ones. But Ting is the one that I use. It's a Sprint network reseller. And I got an email from them a couple months ago. It said, hey, just letting you know, we're lowering our rates. Yep, you heard us right. We're lowering our rates.
Awesome.
No, it's not because of any lawsuits. And you don't have to do anything to get the new rate.
Right.
Just let you know it's happening. Keep on living your life, and awesome. You're going to get less money.
Not the way Verizon did it.
Yes, exactly. So if you're a cell phone coverage company, don't follow in Verizon's lead.
Okay. If you're using Verizon and you want to drop your rate, what you need to do is you need to go get a cup of tea, sit down, have a phone next to you, have a book, because you're going to be on hold for a long time.
Get a pot of tea.
It'll get cold by the time you're done. Anyway, call up Verizon and have them do it. Well, what about Office? What about Office Depot story?
Oh, yeah.
Or should I jump in here first?
Staples is buying Office Depot for $6.3 billion.
So Office Depot, I guess, will go away and it'll just be Staples.
I guess so.
Monopoly!
That's a great game.
Hey, that is a great game. So speaking of like monopolies, Amazon in the U.S. is the such a powerhouse. I mean, it used to be that they only killed bookstores, but now Radio Shack is dying basically because of Amazon. But basically, you know,
Amazon, just briefly, yeah. Amazon has a tendril in every market,
yeah,
I can think of. They do web serving, they do retail, they do books, they do everything.
Everything online possible, right? I mean, in fact, we talked about Netflix earlier. All of Netflix stuff is actually on Amazon's cloud service, right? Like, Amazon's huge.
It's probably because they've never made profit. They've just reinvested all the money that they've made.
They do a really good job of reinvesting, growing. Anyway, in that process, we've seen bookstores close, right? Because mm-hmm. people buy. But, you know, people still like bookstores, right? I mean,
I like bookstores.
Yeah, we've got some great bookstores in Santa Cruz area. I ran into a great bookstore when I was in Slo County last weekend. And so there's great bookstores around. And I think the reason that was we like bookstores. Like, physical places are great.
Yeah.
One of the examples of bookstores is college bookstores. Every college has a bookstore because the students have to come in and order their books and get them. And of course, they have dorms, but they don't really have package delivery at the dorms. It's really a kind of a pain to buy things online. Mm-hmm. And so bookstores at colleges have been a standard fare for a while that Amazon hasn't attacked. Well, guess what?
Amazon, I can only guess.
At Purdue College, Amazon is opening their first physical bookstore at a college.
What?
Yes.
That's crazy.
It's called Amazon at Purdue.
And Amazon
at Purdue. And the bookstore is in the campus. It's a real physical store. You can buy stuff from Amazon and get it and pick it up there. And the employees are Amazon employees. Yay, full circle. Amazon now has bookstores.
Whoa.
So I'm just hoping
that Borders just went away a couple years ago.
Yeah, and years from now, I'm sure they'll open a Radio Shack. But in any case, interesting story, of course. The deal with Purdue is probably good for them because Purdue doesn't really want to be a bookseller. Colleges normally have to do that as well. And of course, the prices are probably good for the students. Chandler, our intern, said, oh, good. Because, of course, every student wants to buy the cheapest book possible. You have to buy these expensive books, and then you have them for a quarter, and then they're gone, you know.
That's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Hey, I got one more story I want to cover before you leave, which is this is my Wikipedia editor spotlight.
Ah.
One of the top 1,000 editors on Wikipedia spends roughly an hour a day editing Wikipedia, only changing comprised of to is composed of or consists of.
Wait, that phrase?
That phrase. He searches for the phrase comprised of. And he replaces it with a grammatically correct version. He's been doing this for years.
Yay! Thanks for the Wikipedia edits.
One step at a time.
Hey, this is Geek Speak. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can do anything you want with our content as long as you give us attribution. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and KOSP.org. To find out more about anything that we do on this show, you can go to geekspeak.org. You can email us at geeks@geekspeak.org, and you can contact us on Twitter, we're KOSP Geeks. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxel. In the air with me was Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben, thanks for joining me today.
See you later.
Yeah. This is the episode for February 7th, 2015.